Okay, so the homework is due, and oh, that's not too good. Okay, and so the homework is due. The midterm is Tuesday, right after the spring break, and since you may or may not get to see flowers during the spring break, I put some there for you. So, do computer science people actually go on spring break? That sort of makes no sense, right? So, yeah. What? What? Yeah, that's the usual thing. Okay. So, and then what else? Regarding this, the midterm, that's what would be covered. Okay? So everything, including basically everything that's sort of covered in the first two homeworks, are going to be covered. Okay. Yes. Now you'll have enough fun with that in the project. Nothing about list. Nothing about list. So you in fact had previous exam questions. Several of them. I mean, there was one of the project two. Thing, the true false things was like that, for example. Okay, so in general, the exam is going to be, I mean, I'm not going to be able to ask the kind of questions I can ask on the homework, because homework are sometimes slightly more open-ended, and they are sort of fail-soft, in the sense, even if you don't actually complete all the homework, you'll still be able to get, it's only like 5 points per homework. So whereas the exams are going to be easier comparatively, but that issue would be time pressure. Okay, so if you are trying to read everything during the exam, that's not going to help. Okay, so you may want to read beforehand. Do you guys want open book or closed book? What? What? I don't know. See, look, I don't really care whichever way, but in general I find that if people are trying to read it during the exam, they don't get anywhere. It'll take too much time just flipping the slides to get there. So doesn't look like there's any strong thing on your side either. Closed? Okay. Okay. Okay, so what else? Any other questions regarding the exam? So reviewing the last class, I have very modest aims for today's class to be slightly better than last class, because I think they're about 70% were sleeping, so we'll hope for maybe only 65% in this class. So what's the, let's try to see if any of this actually went through. Who is going to tell me what is actually the difficult part of reasoning with uncertainty compared to, let's say, propositional logic reasoning? Okay, is it the complexity of reasoning itself or the assessment of probabilities? What? Complexity of reasoning, who compared to propositional logic, what's the complexity of reasoning in propositional logic? Yeah. It's exponential, basically it's NP complete there, it's co-NP complete. And it's the same here. So you're sunk in both cases. So that's not really the main thing. You will learn, reasoning procedures for this particular, probabilistic reasoning, but that's not the big deal. You should be surprised that nothing worse happened when you went from propositional logic to probabilistic logic. You didn't change the complexity class. You're still in exponential time, basically. Okay. So what is the other thing? The other thing that we have is this probabilities. Assessment of probabilities. So in addition to a propositional theory, now you're supposedly giving joint distribution, and where are these numbers coming from? Okay, that's a big issue. So again, this question is with respect to propositional logic. You know, everything else that propositional logic is doing, let's assume, is cheap. Okay, if you don't complain about that. Okay, so for example, in propositional logic, you still have to give domain axioms, right? You have to give the constraints, and you don't complain about that. Okay, but on top of it, now you have to give numbers too. These probabilities for the, you know, the joint distribution, and that is an extra piece that you have to do for probabilistic reasoning that you didn't have to do for propositional logic. Okay, so a different question is, we made a point that joint distribution is enough for answering all queries, right? That's what we did the whole of last class. Joint distribution. If I give you joint distribution, then you can answer every possible propositional query. Just as if I give you the truth table, you can answer every possible propositional logic query. Right? Maybe not efficiently, but at least conceptually, you can do that. Okay? So if I have joint distribution, you know, joint distribution is sort of like the truth table based approach for theorem proving in propositional logic. If you use joint distribution in probabilistic logic to answer queries, then you are essentially doing the same thing, thing similar to what you did when you wrote an entire truth table and tried to write the knowledge base column and the theorem that you're trying to prove column, and checking that in every world where the knowledge base is true, the theorem is true. Or in fact, you could put an extra column called knowledge base and the not of the theorem, and then that should be false everywhere. This is the way you could prove the theorem, right, in the propositional logic. Similarly, if I have the entire joint distribution, you can, using just elementary rules of probability, you can compute any query's probability. Okay, that's what we talked about. Now, joint distribution is just 2 power n numbers, right? If there are n discrete variables, you need 2 power n numbers. So where do we, if that's all you need, then what exactly is the role of domain knowledge? Yes. Again, I hope you understand that. Okay. I mean, I hope you understand that ultimately the reason domain knowledge helps, in fact, that's what we spent a lot of time last class explaining, and we'll go a lot more into it today, is the more you know about the domain, the easier it will be for you, or easier or harder it will be to, you know, actually specify the joint distribution. The worst case for specifying joint distribution is giving 2 power n independent numbers, all of which add up to 1. There are infinite number of ways of doing that. Okay. The issue is, if I can give you much fewer than 2 power n numbers from which you can get the 2 power n numbers you need, and then you can do all your theorems, all your probabilistic reasoning, then that will be very much easier. Okay. So the domain knowledge, for example, a really, really, really simplifying domain knowledge would be saying, in my domain, there are no constraints. Every variable is independent of every other variable. Even in that case, joint distribution still has 2 power n numbers. Even in that case, joint distribution still has 2 power n numbers. Okay? Just as whether or not in propositional logic, whether or not you have clauses in the propositional logic with extra constraints, if I tell you that there are n propositions, the truth table size is always 2 power n. That's it. And similarly, if there are n variables, joint distribution size is always 2 power n. But you can get those 2 power n numbers with some much fewer numbers. If, for example, everything is independent, if all n variables are independent, then all I need is the probability that each of the variable takes true value. That's it. Given that, then I can compute every possible joint distribution entry. And once I compute the joint distribution entry, then I can compute everything else. Okay, so conceptually, you want to remember this, that if there is a way of getting joint distribution from whatever you have, then from here, every query can be answered. Okay? Now, you actually, to do efficient reasoning, you don't actually ever explicitly compute the joint distribution. Do you understand what I'm saying? Just as to do efficient propositional logic reasoning, you would never want to write down the entire truth table. It's just too large. Okay, but conceptually, you know, you want to think about it this way. The numbers that I'm given, can I use them to compute a joint distribution? If so, then I essentially have semantics, because now I can actually answer every possible query using the rules of probability theory. Okay, and the domain knowledge reduces, hopefully reduces the number of numbers you need to specify the joint distribution. It can never be more than 2 power n. It can be as little as 1, I mean, it can actually be as little as no numbers, because I said, if everything is independent of everything, and it's a Boolean variable, and they are equally likely to be true or false, then I don't need to tell you any numbers, because it's half probability for everything, right? And then what you would get then basically would be a joint binomial distribution. Okay, so it's like each, you know, each variable is a coin toss, a fair coin toss. Okay, so, and the domain theory, so no numbers, and you know, most likely you would need n numbers if everything is independent, but you can go anywhere between n to 2 power n numbers depending on how the domain is. If things are too dependent in the domain, it will be 2 power n. If there are very few dependencies, it will be much less than 2 power n. And one thing you can already think of, suppose, is suppose there are n variables, and I said this last time too, so there is m less than n subset of these variables are dependent on each other, and the rest of the variables are independent. I mean, there are basically no connections. Okay, then what happens? You essentially would need only 2 power m maximum numbers. Order of 2 power m maximum numbers, because the other stuff is independent. So the more you know about the domain, the more you can talk about independences that hold in the domain, the better off you are. That's the whole point. Okay? Any questions on this stuff? Okay. I asked on the blog, what's the difference between probability and statistics? And there's only one guy tried answering it. In fact, only one guy tried answering anything at all on that. But you heard about this, right? You heard about probability and statistics. What's the difference? No. Yes.
Probability is predictive and statistics is analytical.
What does that mean?
Statistics would be based on an experiment. Probability would be based on observation.
Statistics gives a point estimate of any quantity, like an exact number for any quantity, whereas probability gives a space where the quantity can fall.
Okay, so I want you to think of, there probably are other ways of thinking about it, but I want you to think about it this way, because this actually is very useful. You come into the world, okay? I am trying to learn about this class. I gave a midterm. I got a whole number of marks, you know, student 1, some marks, student 2, you know, 45, student 3, 75, etc., etc., etc. These are numbers that I got. These are observations I made about your intellectual capabilities, assuming that my exam can actually measure those intellectual capabilities. Okay, then I compute statistics. And I say I compute statistics, that's what you heard, right? I mean, you keep asking me, what's the statistics for the homework? What's the statistics for the homework? You don't ask me, what's the probability for the homework? Right? Why don't you? Because the statistics essentially are going from the data to compute the joint distribution. Do you understand what I'm saying? So your hope, your assumption is this data has been produced by some joint distribution. Okay? And that produced these numbers, and I'm trying to unearth the joint distribution by computing the statistics. Because if I have the joint distribution, then I don't need you anymore in the class. I can set a new exam and then predict what's the probability that the average of this class would be less than 10 or more than 20. Do you understand what I'm saying? Statistics is learning, or model learning. Probability is reasoning or inference. See, when they say probability and statistics, if you are given joint distributions in the elementary probability problems, all of them would be about the sickening six-faced die, right? You throw a couple of dice, and then what's the probability that something will happen? Okay, now you could not ask that question unless it was already common knowledge that the distribution of faces, the distribution with which the faces come on the dice is 1/6, 1/6, 1/6. If in fact I got these, fancy dice, fuzzy dice maybe from Japan, which such that certain faces come with much higher probability than other faces, and you're happily crunching away your numbers, they're useless numbers because you started with the wrong distribution. Okay, normal expectation is that before you want me to do this problem, give me the distribution. And that's what I would like you to do too here. Before you ask me to set up an exam, tell me about your capabilities. But then unfortunately, you don't know how to tell me about your capabilities. So I do an experiment such as midterm or homework. And then I get a bunch of numbers. And then I try to learn or induce the distribution from this small data. Okay, now, when we say statistics, normally you always say, mu, sigma, the average is 50 points, deviation is 25 points, or something. Right, that's all you need. Why is it that this doesn't look like a joint distribution? It is a distribution because you made an extra assumption. You made an assumption that while I don't know what the joint distribution actually is, I'll go ahead and assume it's a bell curve. Okay? That's a huge bias. I make an assumption that what I'm looking for has a certain shape. And once I assume it's going to be bell curve, then all I need to do is to estimate two parameters. And that will tell me exactly what's the closest bell curve that would correspond to a joint distribution for you. So the huge leap of faith I made here is to assume that what I'm looking for is a joint, is a bell curve already. Okay? And in learning, you always wind up doing this. You always make some bias or other. Otherwise, learning is too impossible. We'll talk about this. The word bias, you normally heard it as a bad thing before you came to this class. But when we start talking about learning, we'll look at it as a good thing. Because without bias, you would never have learned a thing in your life. Without bias, you'd never have learned a thing because think of yourself as a kid, okay? And, father or mother is, holding you in hands and then taking you to the straight, into the nearby road. And there's like a bus going. And then she shows and says, bus. Okay, what is bus? What is bus? The whole thing is bus? The 15th window in the bus? Is the driver driving the bus? Are the kids yelling at the top of their voices, the bus? What do you think is bus? And yet you have to, if you are like one of these really brainy kids, you will say, I'll wait around, I'll let my mom or dad show me up to a billion buses. And then I will figure out what the pattern is. And then you would be quickly run over by one of them. Right? Right? So you actually jump to conclusions. Okay? All kids have what's called a whole object bias. We are born into the world with a whole object bias. So up front, when somebody shows this thing, say, the class. I don't mean that person, the class. The whole thing, this whole thing is the class. Okay? And that reduces the complexity of learning. And the complexity of learning, by the way, since we are talking about this, what would be, how do you decide the complexity of learning? The normal idea is, remember this kid who, the brainy kid who required billion bus samples before he could figure out, he or she could figure out what the bus is? You don't call them brainy kids, you call them somewhat dimwitted, because they're taking too long. They may be brainy, but they'll get run over. Okay? Their learning is slow because they required too many observations, too many samples. Difficulty of learning is always thought of in terms of sample complexity. How many samples are needed to learn? Okay? And then, so really, when, and I had to do this in the statistics versus probability issue too, because I have 35 people in the class. And based on the 35 people in the class, and just one exam, that's the only samples I have, I needed to come up with a joint distribution. And I had to cut corners. So for example, I had to assume that everything, that instead of looking for 2 power n numbers from few numbers, what I assumed is these are the numbers and this is the shape of the curve. And so I really need only 2 numbers, the average and the deviation. The big jump I made is here. Just as the big jump the kid made when he or she decided the whole thing is the bus, is the whole object bias. That's the big thing they made. Otherwise, there are so many, many possibilities as to what the bus is. And you will never be able to have enough examples to figure out what is really bus. Okay? Since we are talking about the bias here, let me just say one more thing, which is, this is actually another way why, how actually people figured out that we are born into this world with huge grammars inbuilt in our heads. Because the argument as to why we must be born into the world with a grammar for languages, human languages built in, goes as by saying that before you start making up complete sentences, you have not heard enough sentences and enough words to actually be able to come up with these new sentences if you didn't already have a grammar in your head. What really happens is, just as I came up with a bias of normal distribution, Gaussian distribution, and so I only needed to get 2 numbers from your midterm performance. Kids come into the world, according to our best understanding right now, with a universal grammar, which essentially can tune itself to every possible human language. It hasn't yet been shown that it can tune itself to dog's language or the wolf's language, if they have one. Okay? The kid, when they're born, they don't know where the heck they're going to be born. And it has nothing to do with genetics. It doesn't matter if they're born in Tempe and you take them to Sudan, they will learn the language, local language there. You don't need a separate, you know, consulate school for them. And the only reason that is possible is because they're born with essentially a universal grammar, and using the examples, they're only tuning the parameters for the language, the grammar. Just as using the examples of the student, actual student performance, I'm only tuning the parameters for my normal distribution curve, which are much fewer in number than full joint distribution. Okay, so in some sense, while we'll go back to actually Bayes networks and conditional independences, it is important to understand the bigger picture, which we'll get back to again later. Statistics is really learning the model of the data from the data. And once I have the statistics, I have the joint distribution. And then the probability theory tells me, given the joint distribution, how to compute all possible crazy queries. Okay? Questions? Okay, so the next time you hear probability and statistics, you know at least one good way of understanding them. Okay, so we were talking about this last time. We spent a lot of time on joint distribution and how you can use it. And if you just go directly with joint distribution, so remember I had this picture saying, conceptually, whatever you have, if you can think of how it will describe a joint distribution, then you can do inference. Then you can do probabilistic inference. The question is, you need to decide what numbers do you start with. The first idea, because we are you know, we didn't have particularly good imaginations. We thought, since joint distribution requires joint probabilities, let's assume that what we have is joint probabilities. We actually are carrying 2 power n joint probabilities, and so that defines the joint distribution, and so it gives you the inference. That's what we did last class, right? Now the problem, of course, is the kind of numbers you need then is, if there are n variables, you know, there are n Boolean variables, you would need numbers of the form x1 and not x2 and x3 and x4 and not x5 and x6, etc., up to xn. What's the probability that they will take these truth-falsity values? That's exactly the kind of numbers you need. If you do them, then essentially you have every number for the joint distribution already directly. Right? This means basically we have to look at all entities in the world and see which fraction of them, all entities in all possible, you know, in the world that you have access to, and see which fraction of them have those properties. So all those variables have those specific values. These are extremely painful experiments to set up, because I'm trying to assess probability, assess the parameters. Right? So this is a difficult experiment to set up. A different way of setting up experiments, again I mentioned it last time, is to think in terms of conditional probabilities. So keep something constant, and assess the probability of something else being true or false. So probability of A given B. Wake up that guy. Wake up. So today onwards, I'm going to be waking people up. I've taken an extra job, okay? If you need to go out and wash your face, please go. That's fine with me, okay? I never have found myself with that good. My kid would never sleep when I try to sing him lullabies, right? And yet, I'm so much better in the class. I don't know how. Okay, so, okay. The issue, of course, is you're trying to set up an experiment where the evidence, you know, is set. You said when B is true, of the fraction of the worlds where B is true, which fraction of the worlds have A also true? So this will allow us to ask questions such as, of the fraction of people who are known to have flu, of the number of people who are known to have flu, which fraction of them have runny nose? Or of the people who have runny nose, which fraction of them eventually through postmortem have been found to have flu? Right? In fact, that's a sad situation. Sometimes, you know, the diagnostic probabilities aren't easy to assess, because only after you're dead and gone would we actually know whether you're suffering from a certain disease or not. Okay? These are easier numbers to compute. Okay, here every possible number is of this form. Here at least there are fewer, you know, there are some numbers which are simpler assessments. Eventually they do get baroque too. For example, if you don't have any other domain knowledge, you will start doing things like, what's the probability that x1 is true, x2 is false, etc., up to xm, given y1 is true, y2 is false, ym is false, and so on. This is starting to look as bad an experiment as this. However, here every experiment is as bad as this. Here, only some of the experiments are as bad as this. So if you are lucky, you can get by with, you know, conditional probabilities that are easier to compute. Okay? So, we are interested in learning how we can use conditional probabilities. That's the whole point of coming here. And that was this Bayes rule that we're going to get to. Okay? But once you're starting to talk about conditional probabilities, you can have two types of conditional. Basically, a conditional probability doesn't necessarily say, when you say A given B, A can be causing B, B can be causing A, neither of them are causing anything. All you are saying is they're just correlated. Okay, so for example, what's the probability that people, I can say, what's the probability that if you have flu, you have runny nose? That means in this case, flu is causing runny nose. It's a causal probability. I can ask, what's the probability that if you have runny nose, you have flu, which is a diagnostic probability. This is the one, you know, doctors are interested in. And I can also say, what is the probability that if you have runny nose, you have achy body. These are only correlated. So if you actually have flu, it will cause both the runny nose and the achy body, or body aches. Okay, I mean, achy body may be caused for other reasons too. But all of these could be caused for other reasons too. But in general, if you see one symptom, maybe there is a correlation possibility that the other symptom is also present. Now, in conditional probabilities, there is no actual direction. You can ask anything given anything. Okay? However, you could talk about, if you are out there assessing the probabilities, which would be the probabilities you would like to assess? Diagnostic or causal probabilities? Would you rather assess probability that somebody who has flu has runny nose, or assess the probability that somebody having runny nose has flu? Which is better to assess? So the interesting question, of course, is you kind of agree, I guess, that you want the causal probability, that means effect given cause. Okay, so if you have flu, what's the probability that you have runny nose? If you have flu, what's the probability that you have body aches? And this is the only reason why you actually need doctors, because if you actually have these other numbers, then you don't even need to go to the doctor. You have just as a logarithms table, there is also a, you know, flu table. And you just plug in, you know, I have runny nose, I have this, you know, so what's the probability that I have flu? And it will tell you exactly. You don't need to waste your money on doctors. Okay? The reason you can't do it is because you actually assess these probabilities. If you have flu, the probability that you have runny nose is this much. If you have flu, the probability that you have achy body aches is this much. And then the doctors invert it. I mean, they don't necessarily have calculators, but in essence, diagnostic reasoning involves using causal probabilities to compute diagnostic probabilities. Okay? The reason this is actually worth doing is not because we want to be nice to doctors, but because if you are trying to assess probabilities, you want to be able to do it once and not have to repeat it every other day and in every other place. Okay, so the question is, if I'm assessing these two probabilities, probability of runny nose given flu versus probability of flu given runny nose, which of these probabilities do you think, once you assess, are likely to hold not just today but also tomorrow, and not just here but also in San Diego? And also on the East Coast. And also in Sudan. Causal. Why? Because the runny nose, you may have runny nose for reasons other than flu, for example. So if you, for example, go to East Coast about this time of the year, there are huge amounts of pollen allergy. So if you saw me when I was going to grad school in Maryland, my eyes would be much bigger by about this time. Okay? So a huge amount of pollen allergy, so I have major runny nose, I have big eyes, and I don't have flu. Okay? So you have to consider different probabilities for people in Maryland with runny noses versus people in Phoenix with runny noses. People in Phoenix with runny noses are more likely to be having flu than people in Maryland with runny noses having flu, because they could just be having allergy. And similarly, if you don't like this, you can look at toothache given cavity. Now you can forget about primary physician and go to dentistry, and cavity given toothache. Okay, near an ice cream factory, obviously everybody has a toothache because they ate way too much ice cream. So this probability near an ice cream factory is going to be different from somewhere else where there is no ice cream. But this, on the other hand, is going to be more stable. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? So it's because of this that you can write a Clark's table. You can write a flu probability table, print it once and forget about it. Okay? If you remember these probabilities, the causal ones, rather than the diagnostic one. This is the reason why we tend to pick all causal, assess all the causal probabilities, and then reason with them, you know, to compute the diagnostic probabilities. Okay? So that's the whole point. So you have to understand why, you know, effect versus cause is, why do you need the inversion? Because these numbers, even if you assess them here, you have to reassess them in Washington. You have to reassess them in San Diego, and so on and so forth. Okay? So, you know, the other interesting thing, of course, is while I do have these probabilities, you know, effect given cause, what's the probability that if I have flu, I will have runny nose? Doctors can't just look into the tables and help their patients because, as I point out, and I pointed out last time too, very few patients go all the way to the doctor and tell them, I already have flu, could you check if I have runny nose? There's really no money in doing that kind of a medical advice. They want the opposite advice. Okay? So, the question is, if I have effect given cause probabilities, can I convert it into cause given effect probabilities? This is where Reverend Bayes comes into play. Okay? Because Bayes rule essentially just says that, look, P, A, and B can be written in two different ways. If you just use the definition of conditional probability, P, A, and B given as, can be given as P, A given B times P, B, or P, B given A times P, A. So if A is effect and B is cause, then you can invert the conditional probability just by, you know, by writing one in terms of the other. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's the whole reason why Bayes rule is interesting. It's not because he did elementary algebra, but because he's giving you a way of getting probabilities that everybody wants from probabilities that everybody is likely to have. Because the causal probabilities are the ones that you're likely to have. Okay? So cause given effect is written as effect given cause times probability, prior probability of cause itself by prior probability of effect itself. That's what you wind up writing. Okay? Now, one of the interesting things is that of those numbers, so if you are a medical practitioner, so first of all, you can see that in this case, if M is meningitis and S is stiff neck, so we no longer like dentistry when we go back again to something else, you know, meningitis and stiff neck. And so meningitis given stiff neck is stiff neck given meningitis times probability of meningitis by probability of stiff neck. Okay. Now, of these, the probability of meningitis, you know, what's the probability that meningitis is likely to hold in a random population? That's, you know, according to this, you know, this number is just saying 0.0001. Very low probability. What's the probability that if you have meningitis, you will have stiff neck? Very high probability. What's the probability that a random person will have a stiff neck? That's 0.1. That's prior probability of a random person having just stiff neck. And so you combine these, and you get 0.0008. So the evidence of stiff neck did increase your belief in this person having meningitis. Right? Because if you don't know anything, when the patient walked in, all that the doctor knew is P of M. Because their, you know, prior probabilities would have told them, what's the probability that a random person walking in has meningitis? But then the moment they said, oh, no, I'm having stiff neck, then you can say, well, you have slightly higher chance that you have meningitis. That's what you did here. Okay? Now, having made a huge deal about how nice causal probabilities are, probability of stiff neck given meningitis, you know, which is easy to compute because you only go to people who have been already diagnosed to have meningitis and then just ask them, how many of you are having stiff neck? Right? That's basically what those numbers are, really. Okay, but then that's not enough, it turns out. I do need this number as well as this number. That's, since we talked about how likely our numbers going to have to change from place to place, let's talk about this too. What's the probability of meningitis? Is the probability of meningitis going to change from place to place or not? kind of, sort of. Okay? So that sort of change. How about probability of stiff neck? Why doesn't it change? You go to a mountaineering institute, all of them have stiff neck. Right? And all I need to do is put this board up here and all of you will have stiff neck. And that's not because you all have suddenly extra meningitis. Do you understand what I'm saying? So both of these numbers are actually the kind of numbers that you don't quite like. Okay, this is a good number, but these can change from place to place. So one question would be, can we get away without having to compute at least one of those numbers? Okay, and I'll tell you that if you don't mind computing probability, so you just now computed probability of meningitis given stiff neck, which is probability of stiff neck given meningitis times probability of meningitis by probability of stiff neck. Okay, and let's say that, I don't know, I'll just make up some numbers. Let's say that, you know, point, what is it, 0.0008, that's what it was. And I can also compute, let's say, using the same rules, I also decide to compute probability of not meningitis, that means no meningitis, given stiff neck. That would be probability of stiff neck given no meningitis times probability of no meningitis by probability of stiff neck. This number and this number are actually the same, right? Because 1 minus the first number is the second number. So you didn't need an extra number for the prior probability. Okay? This you do need to compute because this is different from this. If you don't mind getting this extra number, this is also a causal probability. You know, after people who don't have meningitis, how many of them have stiff neck? Okay? If you can compute that, then the advantage is if you sum these up, this must be equal to 1. Okay? So I can say, let's say 1 over p of s is alpha. Okay? Then I can say, I got here, I never even computed this number, p of s. I will just get alpha times 0.4, let's say here. And I'll get the same alpha times 0.6 here. Okay, maybe not 0.6, let's make it 0.5. Okay, then all I say is alpha times 0.4 plus 0.5 equal to 1. So I know alpha now. Do you understand what I'm saying? So this is, you know, it looks as if it's a huge amount of, if you don't understand why you are doing it, it looks like all I wanted was this one probability. Why are you computing this probability too? Okay? And why I'm computing this probability just so that I don't need to compute these probabilities. And, you know, if you are in medicine in particular, people do give prior probability of diseases for various regions. But they don't give prior probability of symptoms for various reasons. They can't possibly give prior probability of symptoms for various reasons. Imagine in this class, if I put this slide projector high up, then you'd all be looking like this, and so your prior probability of having stiff neck is very different from the guys who are right outside the room. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's very, very painful to get this number because you would need this number for every possible different scenario. And by doing this, you avoided ever asking for that number. Okay, and this idea is called normalization. Because all you did was alpha times 0.4 plus alpha times 0.5 must be equal to 1, so that gives you what alpha is supposed to be. And in general, in fact, in this particular case, meningitis is either true or false. If you have a multi-valued variable, which has n values, then you would need to compute n of these probabilities, probability that the variable has value 1, value 2, value 3, all the way up to value n. Add them all up, just so that you did not have to compute this number. Assess this number. Okay. By the way, you need to differentiate between assess versus compute. Compute means you just start off doing some multiplications, additions from the numbers that you've been given. So you're doing probability. SS means you're doing statistics. You're taking the data and coming up with numbers that represent that data. Okay? And so you can avoid assessing this if you compute this for Boolean variables. Okay. Now the interesting thing about this is, remember I said when we first talked about inference rules, we said if you have whole bunch of, if you have 1,000 variables, right, and then there is one, let's say, and then there are like 10,000 classes, and one class basically said P implies Q, so this is the 900th class, and here is the 7,995th class which said P, and if you just wanted to see whether Q is entailed, using truth table method, first you need to set up a truth table which would have 2^1,000 rows, and after you do that, then you will say, just give me 3-4 days, I'll set up the truth table, then I'll come back and very quickly tell you, blazingly fast, that yes, Q is actually entailed. Okay, now the same thing, if you are doing it from joint distribution, you would need all the joint distribution entries, and then you can marginalize everybody else to answer a query. The advantage of Bayes' rule is that this basically, you could be involved in a world where there are huge number of diseases, huge number of symptoms, and yet if you know these three numbers, you can compute the probability that somebody having this symptom has this disease without having to explicate the entire joint distribution. So think of this as a nice inference rule, almost like modest ponens. Okay, it doesn't have to look at the entire joint distribution just to answer a couple of queries. In the worst case, it will. But in the best case, it can get by much faster. Okay, so that's the other point that you want to keep in mind. Any questions up to this? Yes?
So in general, can we say that the bias of effects are hard to calculate?
Sort of. That's more or less what we were saying. Actually, this whole discussion is so much more easy to understand if you do it in terms of medicine, because you have very good intuitions. When I say disease probabilities are easier to assess than, stiff neck probabilities, you could agree with me. If I generally said effect probabilities are harder to assess than, cause probabilities, you'd say what? I don't know which effect you're talking about, which cause you're talking about. Okay? But in general, that's sort of what we are arguing here. Okay. So what happens if you have multiple symptoms? So this looks a little too good, right? This looks a little too good, because you're saying how many ever variables are there, if you give me three magic numbers, I'll do an addition, a multiplication and a division, and I'll give you a new number that you wanted always. Okay? The problem, of course, is, since in the worst case, you cannot be any better than exponential, you have to be giving up something somewhere. So the question is, what are we giving up? Where do you wind up needing? So if I only have these kinds of numbers, they are not that many numbers, right? Because it's just one variable here, one variable here. So if there are n diseases and m symptoms, that this is just m times n, that's it. Not 2^m, which is much, much more ugly. So it looks like you can get by with much fewer numbers, get by assessing much fewer numbers. And even that, we were lazy enough to avoid assessing numbers like P of S by just assessing two extra numbers. Remember that what you can compute is much faster than what you need to assess. In fact, in that previous case, if you said, no, I'm not going to compute one more thing, give me the number that I need, then they have to go into the world and do an experiment and figure out what's the probability of stiff neck and give it to you. Whereas computers, they're much faster. Can't you do an extra multiplication and division just so that you can stop me from going out and doing an extra experiment, my extra huge number of experiments to give you a number? Okay, avoiding assessment by doing extra computation is a win-win situation. Okay. Now, it all looks great, but it has to catch up with us. Somewhere we need to wind up needing too many numbers. So when does that happen? So what happens if we have multiple symptoms? Okay, what happens if this kid who comes in, you know, doesn't, you know, the doctor says, so do you have stiff, you know, what's your problem? And he says, stiff neck, and then going back in this particular case, patient walks in and, you know, they say, I have toothache. Okay, so the doctor very quickly uses the base, you know, rule to compute the probability of cavity given toothache. Okay, now basically, you know, you try to probe the patient's mouth with that steel thingy, which some of you should be done to right now to wake you up, and the steel thingy will catch. You know, it's a really yucky thing to happen, right? And that means you actually have a real cavity. That steel thing got stuck in it, and if they pull it, your entire tooth will come out. Okay, but let's not get into those gory details. The point is, you have found an extra symptom. Now, it's not just toothache. It's not, you know, if you have just ice cream, if you just ate like 2 gallons of ice cream and went to the doctor and said, doctor, I'm having toothache, and if the doctor does a test with this steel thingy, you know, other than catching some ice cream left over, you can't catch anything. But if you actually have a cavity, then this thing catches. Okay? So, now the question is, you're the doctor. You tell me how you're going to update your probability that the patient has cavity. This actually tells you something more interesting too. As you do tests, the reason doctors do tests is to compute the probability of disease given additional evidence about the symptoms that you have. And if you are, you know, if you have one of these student insurances, as soon as you go in, they say, here are antibiotics. Because no tests are needed for you guys. You know, you just take antibiotics. You know, tests are too costly for you. Okay, so that's basically what happens in reality, right? So here in this case, this guy apparently has insurance, and so they actually took the steel thing and did something, and then it got cut, right? So now the doctor wants to compute probability of cavity given toothache and catch. Catch being, you know, what happens when that thing got stuck. So that's actually a symptom now, right? If you just use Bayes' rule, this is what you would get. Bayes' rule works for, you know, sets of variables just as it does for single variables. Right? So you would need probability of toothache and catch given cavity times probability of cavity divided by probability of toothache and catch together. Okay? And previously, you already have numbers like, in the first one, you already figured out the numbers like probability of toothache given cavity. And you also know the probability of cavity. So you have this number already, and you also have probability of toothache given cavity. Can you get by with that? I need this number. I also would ignore this guy, because by normalizing, I can ignore the denominator, right? If I normalize, I can ignore the denominator. So ultimately, the culprit is this. How do I get this number? Remember, if you now ask me to go out and get me one more probability, I'll get really mad at you, because that would mean assessment. One more extra experiment. One more extra number that needs to have been given as input to you. What happens? You cannot just get this number from the numbers that you have unless you make additional assumptions. Unless you make additional assumptions. Okay? Now, one assumption I can make is everything is independent, which is a great assumption. We already made it once, right? But then that's just too strong an assumption. That's a very useful assumption. If everything is independent of everything, then probability of toothache given cavity is the same as probability of toothache, because cavity doesn't change anything. Okay? And so probability of toothache and catch given cavity is just probability of toothache and catch which is probability of toothache times probability of catch. If everything is independent, I just don't need any number rather than the n numbers I started with. But that's just a little too big an assumption. What I'm interested in is trying to see if I can get by with smaller assumptions. And one reasonable thing is to say that toothache and cavity have a common cause. They're being caused in this case, basically, toothache and catch have a common cause. Okay? They're being both caused by cavity. So if I already told you the status of cavity, then toothache is independent of catch. Do you understand what I'm saying? So this is a different kind of independence. This is conditional independence. So what I'm saying is, I would say, in fact, I would use this notation now, and I'll say independence, to write about independence, I'll say A is independent of B. This is extra notation. We never had the ability to talk about independence directly previously. You know how to use it, but you didn't know how to talk about it. Okay? So this is absolute independence. Now I can also say A is independent of B given C. That's conditional independence. And the point is that if A is independent of B, then PAB is the same as PA times PB. And if A is independent of B only given C, then PAB given C is PA given C times PB given C. So it's almost similar to the previous thing, except now it's both the multiplications are in terms of conditional probabilities. One of the beautiful things, of course, is if this is true, so if this independence holds, then this follows. But if this independence holds, it also follows that A given BC is the same as A given C. Okay, you can figure this out just by using Bayes' rule. But you can also kind of understand that C is what is really causing A and B. So if you know C is there, then the probability of A being true doesn't change because you also told me that B is true. What I really care about is C. Once you tell me C, you don't tell me anything extra by telling me about B. And so similarly, PB given AC is the same as PB given C. So with one conditional independence assumption, you now can actually do all these simplifications. Okay? So in this particular case, basically you need to know this, and if I have conditional independence saying toothache and catch are independent of each other given cavity, that's all I want to say. Okay? So I would say toothache is independent of catch given cavity. If I say that, then essentially I can write toothache and catch given cavity is just obviously same, obviously equal to toothache given cavity times catch given cavity. It's tremendously useful because now you no longer need this number. You can compute this number from these two numbers. And if you had single conditionals, for every symptom and disease, single conditional probabilities, then you can just use them to, as people keep coming in, with extra symptoms, all you do is keep multiplying with this number. That's it. Okay? So, but the assumption you made is independence of symptoms given the cause. Independence of symptoms given the cause. Okay? So if you can make those assumptions, and that will only be holding true in a domain. So you kind of know that catch and cavity have no other ways of, catch and toothache are only caused by cavity in my domain. So once I know cavity, then I know everything about both of them. So it's domain knowledge. Okay? So it's the conditional independences that come to rescue, and whatever I said in the board here, I'm writing here, you can think in terms of absolute independence that you know as just written as A independent of B. A conditional independence is written as X is independent of Y given Z. And to be really general, X can be a set of variables. Y can be a set of variables. Z can be a set of variables. So this set of variables, the home variables of George, are independent of the friendship variables of George, given something. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. So this is really very effect. You know, this is basically the, if you have this conditional independence assertion, then you can write whatever I wrote there in terms of this sets of variables, not just a single variable. Okay. Now the reason this is interesting, in fact we saw it already here, you know, it was interesting because you can get by with one number, but I want to tell you a different way of looking at it. If I have three variables A, B and C, eventually I will need to get the joint distribution on A, B and C to be able to answer every query, right? If there are three Boolean variables, how many probabilities do I need at the most?
Eight.
In fact seven, you know, one I can compute by just subtracting. But if I told you I have three variables and I also told you, well, of the three variables, A is independent of B given C. So if I told you that, you know, of the three variables I have, A is independent of B, B is independent of C, C is independent of A, then you know that I only need three numbers. But alas, that's not my world. Okay, in my world, A is independent of B given C. In that case, probability of A and B and C, probability of A true, B true, C true, using just the chain rule of probability, can be written as A given B and C times PBC. Right? This is just the base rule. You know, I'm basically writing, I mean, if you are forgetting, if you're confused as to why chain rule occurs, just think about it this way. You know, probability of A and B by probability of B is equal to probability of A. I'm sorry, probability of A and B of probability of B is given, is probability of A given B. So really, probability of A and B can be written as probability of A given B times probability of B. So this A, if I have probability of A and C and B, can be written as probability of A and C given B times probability of B, for example. It's just normal, you know, it's just that's just true. It's true for any probability. Okay. So if I have this, I can say probability of A given BC in this case times probability of BC. I can write the other way around too. Okay. Now this A given BC times, now I can write this as probability of A given BC times probability of B given C times probability of C. Now the interesting part is, since A is independent of C, A is independent of B given C, A given BC is the same as A given C. Right? That's the whole point of independence. So this up to here, I didn't say anything about what domain I'm living in. This is just true for any probability and any domain. But in the domain I am in, it turns out that A is independent of B given C, so A given BC is the same as A given C. Okay? And similarly, I have, actually this is a, okay, so, yeah, and then this is probability of B given C, that's just normal number, and probability of C. So the interesting thing is, now any joint entry can be computed from these numbers. How many numbers of this kind are going to be there? How many numbers of this kind are going to be there? How do I get probability of C? Sometimes I might need probability of not C. But if I give you probability of C, you can compute the probability of not C. So one number for this guy. Okay? And probability of B given C, that's two numbers. When C is true, what's the probability that B is true? And when C is false, what's the probability that B is true? The other number, C is true, what's the probability that B is false, is nothing but 1 minus the probability that B is true given C is true. So the independent numbers I need is 1 plus 2 plus 2. 5 numbers compared to what I needed. 8 numbers. A huge improvement. In this case, it looks not particularly surprising, but in a large number of variables, you could reduce the number of independent probabilities you need to assess exponentially. if you do this. Okay, so the our new way to nirvana in probabilistic reasoning is essentially state up front what are the conditional independences, and given that you only need much fewer probabilities, and then with those conditional independences and these probabilities you have a unique joint distribution, and then you're done. Okay, so why not write down all the conditional independence assertions that hold in a domain? Just go ahead and write all these things down. A problem is, since this is a subset of n variables, this is a subset of n variables, this is a subset of n variables, how many possible conditional independence assertions can there be? Exponential number. Okay, now the problem of course is, right, given one independence assertion, then many other independence assertions will just follow. Actually, so suppose I told you A is independent of B given C. If I told you A is independent of B given C, okay, then do I not also need to tell you A and D is independent of E and F given C. A and D is independent of E and F given C. If I tell you this, do I need to tell you this separately? Because this is actually just a special case of this. What I need to do is avoid rewriting redundant conditional independence assertions. Otherwise, I'll go crazy. Okay? So the question then is, while this is a good idea, the problem is there are too many of them. And you would find up writing both this and this, which is unnecessary. So instead, what I want to write is local conditional independences, and let the others just follow by some algebra. Okay. So the idea, the brilliant idea that we come up with is Bayes networks. And in Bayes networks, basically, you would wind up putting a link from a variable to another variable. If the value of this variable is dependent on the value of this variable locally. Okay, so if there is no link between weather and these three, that means weather is independent of all of these guys. And here cavity causes toothache and catch, so cavity, you know, there's a link from cavity to both toothache and catch. Link from both given cavity, you know, from cavity to toothache as well as catch. Now the interesting thing of course is, if you already know cavity, toothache is independent of catch. Now here's the other interesting thing. If I don't know cavity, if somebody just walks in, and what's the probability that you think they are going to have a toothache? Something, let's say. Now you did the steel thingy, and you found they have a catch. Is your probability that you attach to toothache increasing or reducing or remaining the same? If it doesn't change, it's independent. If it changes, it is dependent. Normally, these things are correlated. So if you don't know this, they are still correlated. If you know this, then their correlation only comes through this. So you don't, given cavity, toothache is more or less independent of catch. But not given cavity, toothache is dependent on catch. Do you understand what I'm saying? So the reason here the conditional independence holds is because the only thing that causes both of them is given. And so once I know the cavity, then there is no more correlation between toothache and catch than is flowing through cavity. That's what this particular, you know, picture is telling you. If you believe that toothache and catch can be related even beyond cavity. Actually, you could believe it. I mean, you know, your doctor has a really blunt steel thingy. And so when they are trying to check your tooth, it actually causes toothache. Right? And it has nothing to do with whether you have cavity or not. In that case, you actually have to put an extra thing. You know, whenever you try to look for cavity catch, you actually cause toothache to go up. Okay? So all I'm trying to explain to you is the topology of the Bayes network is essentially telling you the local conditional independence. Okay? And so so what exactly are actually the conditional independence? I already told you that this much, right? Cavity, so toothache is independent of catch given cavity. That much, that would be one of them. Okay? So let me skip over this. I'll come to that later next time when we come back after spring break. But I want you to give you just with this understanding and this particular Bayes network that you have seen, you know, two classes back, you can compute the actual unique joint distribution for these five variables. That's what I want to tell you. So if I give you this network, then what I'm saying is burglary and earthquake sort of together cause alarm to go off. Alarm independently causes joint to call. Alarm independently causes Mary to call. This is what my belief is about how my world works. If this is what I believe, then the only thing I need to give you to specify this Bayes network is a conditional probability table for each node given its immediate parents. That's it. So burglary has no immediate parent. So I just give burglary true, burglary false. If I give true, I know the false. So one number here, probability of burglary. Probability of earthquake, one number here. Okay. Probability of alarm with respect to burglary true, earthquake true. Burglary true, earthquake false. Burglary false, earthquake true. Burglary false, earthquake false. Four numbers are needed. Those are the four numbers here. For John calls, only alarm is the parent. So I need to tell probability that John calls given alarm has gone off, probability that John calls given that alarm doesn't, hasn't gone off. So this is the case where, you know, John feels like calling even though alarm isn't going off. The nice thing is in this network I have shown the possibility that John can call Pearl even though the alarm isn't going up because they just want to say hello. Okay? And similarly Mary calls the two numbers. How many numbers I have given you at this point? How many independent numbers I have given you? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. How many numbers would I need to give you if I didn't make any assumptions? 32 numbers. Looks like it's pretty good, but you can't celebrate yet until you know that these 10 numbers uniquely give you every joint probability distribution entry. That's the last thing I'll tell you, and you get to go home and, you know, see the flowers over the spring break. Okay? So all I'm going to say is this is the kind of entries I would need, right? John calls and Mary calls and alarm goes off and no burglary and no earthquake. If I can compute each of these numbers, each of these 32 numbers from my 10 numbers, then you can't yell at me because I gave you a joint distribution and you know how to deal with every probabilistic query given the joint distribution. So I'll start from J and M and A and not B and not E, and I write this using my chain rule that this is nothing but probability of J given M, A, not B and not E times probability of M, A, and not B, and not E, which can be written multiple second time as M given A, not B, and not E, times probability of A, not B, not E, which can be written as A given not B and E, times P probability of not B and E. That can be written as not B and E given E. I didn't do any magic here. This is just normal chain rule. I just applied it multiple times. Okay? The only question, of course, is where do I get these numbers? The numbers I have are these numbers. If I can get all these numbers from these numbers, I'm done. Let's look at what is happening here. Probability of John calls given Mary, alarm, no burglary, no earthquake. The conditional independence inherent in the Bayes networks tells you, at least it tells you a lot of things. The one thing that it definitely tells you is John is independent of everything given, independent of all of its ancestors and its siblings given its immediate parent. You already know that John is independent of Mary calling if alarm is given, right? But I'm also telling you that John is independent of earthquake given alarm, because whatever earthquake has whatever influence earthquake has on John calls is going through alarm in this picture. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. So if you are living in a world where John has a different reason to call you when earthquake is going on, even if he didn't hear alarm, then you should have put an extra link from earthquake to John calls. In this world, the only reason John calls you is either just like he feels like calling or because he heard alarm. That's my world. Okay, so now John calls given Mary alarm, not B, not E, is nothing but John calls given alarm. Huge improvement. Right? Similarly, Mary calls given A and not B and not E is Mary calls given alarm. And similarly, A given not B and not E is just A given not B and not E. P, probability of not B given E is just not B, because B and E are independent, you know, given their immediate parents, and they have no parents. Okay? And then PE. So this number is multiplication of these numbers. Do you see that all these numbers are present here? So you multiply, you get the number for each of the joint distributions. And so you know, if nothing else, you know that once I give you the base network, and you know, when I give the base network, I have to give these conditional probability tables. And from them, I can compute every joint probability distribution entry, and from that, everything follows. That's where we'll stop. Okay?